Today on the show, I'm talking to William Ryan Key. Young man Ryan made quite a name for himself in the rock band Yellow Card. Didn't know Ryan all that well before our conversation here, but he's a good guy. You know, I'm branching out. I'm talking to strangers more. It's, you know, getting out of my shell here. You can get a lot of information on how to make records and how to record and the intricacies of production from just the internet now. But I think Ryan and I both came up in a time where we were learning hands-on with people that were much better than us. And that gave us an advantage, I think, over people doing it like the book way. My conversation with Mr. William Ryan Key happened October 8th of 2020. Oh, you got a nice chair.
You know, it's funny. My this year has been just insane. Hang on, I'm gonna start recording in Pro Tools here.
I was out in LA. I was in Nashville for 5 years, and I don't know if you want to do this on the show, but talking about the chair. I was in Nashville for 5 years, and I moved to LA. My sister and her kids live there, and I've lived in LA for a long time before I moved to Nashville, but I went back to give it another try. And my writing partner, Ryan Mendez, who's the lead guitar player for Yellow Card, he like has crazy back from a car accident long, long time ago. So I had just like some cheap ass studio, you know, office chair, and he was coming to my house to work every day. And he was like, dude, we gotta solve this chair problem. Like, I can't sit in this chair. So I got a nice chair.
Yeah, I just bought a refurbished.
And I'm glad I did.
I just bought a refurbished Steelcase Leap that I like a lot. It's not this one. This is still my Target from 15 years ago. Target chair.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, dude.
That's like, what I had.
Your chair is a big part of songwriting, man.
I know, man. Especially now, I do. Most of what I'm doing is like scoring and.
Yeah. See, so a chair is a huge deal.
If you sit in it every day for the amount of hours that we sit in them, it's worth the investment.
I mean, we justify buying expensive guitars or gear that
we
same
do.
Way. Like, I'll use it every day. So
yeah.
It makes sense for me to spend $3,000 on this thing right now.
For sure.
I don't know. rent next month? I don't know. But $3,000 right now, it's no problem.
Yeah, especially when I was in Los Angeles and I spent the money on this chair. It was like, hey, maybe it'll work out. Maybe it won't, you know? But with the pandemic, I basically am in a situation now where I can do like one tour a year, like just because it's me and a guitar. It's pretty lucrative, you know what I mean? To just go out on my own like that. And that kind of would have covered the year. But then that disappeared. So I couldn't stay in LA. So
I know
moved
that
back
song.
To Florida, where I grew up, actually. So I'm in Jacksonville,
really?
Florida.
Wait, hold on a second. That's cool. Whereabouts in Florida are you?
It could be a lot worse. It's definitely like a tail tuck thing. You know, like, man, I'm going home for the first time in 21 years. It's wild.
Well,
but I'm in Jacksonville Beach. I'm like 10 blocks from the water.
Oh, that's cool. So it was like in March or something that you moved back?
April. I left April 1st. Yeah. And it all worked out fine. But way.
It looks like you got set up pretty well there.
Yeah, man. I did my first like home studio in Tennessee, where I was in Nashville for 5 years. So it's pretty like, you know, just take it off the walls and put it back up in the new room. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. So we were saying a little bit ago, like how we've definitely crossed paths before, but it's been always kind of like in extreme passing, like different days of the same festival weekend.
Yeah, for sure. And like, or just. I'm sure at some point there was like a, hey man, like, but that was it. That was it. And I mean, dude, your songwriting, your band, I mean, you guys were huge, huge influence on our band. So it was, this is really cool for me.
Well, that's really nice to hear, man. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah, dude.
That's super cool. So in Nashville, you had like your own studio set up there. Were you like recording other people? Were you having, was it like a commercial setup, or was it kind of more like your space that occasionally you let people work in?
It, It evolved when I started to catch wind that there was going to be that Yellow Card was going to be no more. I kind of just thought, okay, well, let's prepare for whatever we're going to do next. And honestly, my first thought was producing other bands. I had done a couple records, nothing big, you know, but I enjoyed it. And I loved making our records. I loved being involved in the production of our records. And over the last two records before we split up, I just got a lot more involved in that process and finally started to be like, you know what, you've been doing this for 15 years. Maybe you should learn something about it, you know? And so I actually did when I kind of knew the band was going to be over, I did a Kickstarter campaign and I basically pitched it as, you know, I'm just going to try to offer as much cool shit as I can in exchange for helping me put together this recording studio because, you know, it's absurdly expensive and I should have been doing that all along when the band was killing it, you know, but I didn't. So.
Was there somebody in Yellow Card that kind of took that role or were you all sort of in the same?
We had like enough to get by to demo, you know, and stuff like that. But we were never self-sufficient as far as making a record. We made all of our records with Neil Avron. Pretty early on, I can't remember how long ago it was, but I guess 10 years ago. Would have been, we kind of split up in 08 for a couple of years, not really knowing if we would go back at it or not, but we did get back at it. And on the second coming, Neil had at that point done his own home studio too in Hollywood. So we weren't working, other than drums, we were doing everything at his place.
Yeah, his place is nice.
I know, man. Have you seen it? You've been to the Casita?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we did. I attended a couple radio mixes that he did.
Oh, cool, cool. Yeah, dude, I love the space, man. Just like if you're not working, you're outside. And we, you know, we've been so close with him and his family for so long that, you know, we have kind of like a little studio B set up in the living room downstairs. And it's like fine for me to just be in there all day. Like his wife, Cheryl, is the sweetest woman alive and she doesn't care. She's like, you need anything to eat? You know, that's kind of the vibe. So
your kids want some sandwiches?
Exactly. Orange wedges. So I learned the last couple of records, like I said, I just really kind of dug in and started to learn more about actually, I have no tolerance for mixing, no patience whatsoever. Like I can't even be bothered, but just the concept of how to get signal into, you know, the machine and like the proper way to do it. I just started to learn about it. So it's been a lot of trial and error. Like I got a whole crap load of gear when I first started and I sort of whittled it down to what I actually use and need. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, it was awesome that everyone, like Yellow Card fans, obviously for the most part, they were like crazy supportive. The Kickstarter was way overfunded, helped me like just really get everything I needed. And we actually made the final Yellow Card record. We self-produced it at my place. And so, yeah, we couldn't have done it without that. So,
Money comes in and it's like, no pressure. It better not suck now.
Yeah, exactly, right? It was like, well, I better make some music
this
now.
Better be good.
Yeah,
that's
for
super
sure.
Rad. And I mean, having a guy like Neil around, because I had a sort of a similar experience. Like, I learned, I was always into recording. Like, I had a cassette 4-track that I would record, like, other bands with, like, other really crappy punk bands around town and, like, in people's dorm rooms. I went to school in Flagstaff for about a semester, about 3 semesters, and I had some buddies in a band, and Friday nights were like blowout. Like you could get as loud, didn't matter, like no noise restrictions from like 5 until like 8 or something on Fridays. So I go record like their band in like a dorm room at a college, and it was so obnoxious, but I mean, that's how I kind of learned originally.
I always think about how, like, when I was a kid, like high school kid, you know, and my first, you know, like, we're gonna call them bands, whatever we sounded like, you know what I mean? But like, we would, you know, we would save up like all summer, whatever summer jobs to get like 3 days in an ADAT studio, like to like.
With the local, with like the metal guy.
Yes.
Who's has no idea what it is you kids are doing.
Listen to this. This is a great story. The guy that we all recorded with here in Jacksonville. I honestly don't remember if it exactly his last name fits something. Fitzpatrick, Fitzgerald, Fitz whatever. Mike Fitz something. So he had this studio, and it was called the music lab or something like that. It was in a strip mall out here at the beach. And so he was just the guy. He had like a monopoly on where teenage kids were going to record their bands at his studio. And so we all started going there and, you'd go for a weekend and you'd get three songs and it was like, that's your vocal take. No, that's it. Like that you're done. Like one time. Moving on, and but anyways, we did all this. So one day, somehow, someone gets into Mike's office. Someone like gets asked to go back there, or someone, whatever. And there's just porn everywhere. Porn on the walls. Porn just sure. everywhere. Turns out that Mike and his buddy that owns a studio with him have a side project called Porno Rock, and have a record of basically think it like Two Live Crew in the 90s, except two like salt washed barefoot Jacksonville Beach Lynyrd Skynyrd listening guys making that kind of record, like the most foul, disgusting lyrics. But we're 16, so we get a hold of this record and it's like the most amazing thing we've ever heard, you know what I mean? But so we were recording our whole high school career with the Porno Rock guy, and that's how it all started for me.
That's pretty amazing. But I mean, you had like a guy like Neil, I knew a little bit about like four-track stuff and like bouncing and mixing to some degree, EQ a little bit, and microphones, nothing. It was just Radio Shack stuff,
right?
Like the highball. But when we started working with like real engineers and producers like Mark Trombino, he was an early adopter on Pro Tools, and
right.
he was a really is like a really talented engineer. So like I got to have a teacher like that around, and it wasn't so much that that was a whole new level for me. I had never done anything like with that kind of thing, with that sort of like depth. But watching him work and seeing what you can do with it, I think jumps you like so far ahead of like other people just starting from scratch, like just using YouTube tutorials to teach themselves like
for
different
sure.
DAW software,
Yep.
So yeah, and Neil's that way too. Like I'm sure that you saw what was saw what was possible. And then it was just sort of a matter of like, okay, I saw them do this. I know what I want to hear. I have to figure out how to do this. I know you can do this. I've seen it happen, but now I just got to figure out how I do it myself.
Yeah. Neil was a very early adopter of Pro Tools as well.
Yeah. He seems like a...
And we hadn't, though. So we made our first... Yellow Card made our first independent record, which is... we were 20 when we recorded it. It's a little tough to listen to. Now that I know what I'm doing and
I know
recording
what you
and
mean.
Stuff at that... You know, yeah, right? So...
I got a couple of those.
So... but we recorded the whole thing analog, mixed the whole thing analog on the board. I mean, zero Pro Tools for that record. And then we made an EP after that with our friend Nick Rucker. We made an EP called the Underdog EP. We did that on Cubase. I think it was Cubase. But I wasn't paying attention. And then we got in the studio for Ocean Avenue with Neil, and Pro Tools was like this thing. And I was like, wait, what is this? Like, how is this possible?
You know?
So that was my first experience with it. But I'll tell you that Neil, while I've learned the basics of EQ and compression and all the things that you need to know to get a good sound, Neil was always a big advocate of use your ears. He turn the knobs until it sounds good. There are basic concepts and rules, but some of the most legendary and revolutionary stuff that you hear on records is going against all the rules and conventions. It's because somebody turned the knobs the wrong way and was like, this sounds really cool. So I've always kind of lived by that, I wouldn't consider myself like super, don't know what the right word is, but even educated. I mean, I know what I'm doing, and I know how to make it sound good, I think. But it's like I also just use my ears and kind of trust that if it sounds good, then I'm doing the right thing. And Neil kind of always taught me that way.
It's like learning a new instrument from scratch. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like, yeah, you're going to occasionally stumble and make something that sounds good or cool. But for the most part, it's a whole lot of practice and a whole lot of just trial and error to pick up the language of it.
Yep.
Until you get to a place where, and it, there's that phase where it's all just in the weeds of understanding the grammar and the vocabulary of the language before you can actually have a conversation with anybody. And that takes a while. It's like a whole different level of musicianship. That's not performance. That's not jamming. It's not music at all. But it's like a musical. It's a musicianship level endeavor to teach yourself like software for yeah, making for music.
Sure. For
and,
sure.
And you got to and you do sort of like lose track of that sometimes. That it is about just hearing and what do you want to hear? What do you like?
Yep.
You know, the rules can take you so far, but after that, it's really up to, you know, what do you want to hear?
Right. And that's a part of why I, like I said, I don't have the patience for mixing per se, because that's not an instrument I want to learn. I'm much more interested in the writing and actually tweaking and creating the sounds than I am the nuance of the frequency and making them all glue together. You know
right.
Yeah.
I mean? The guitars are going to sit here, and if you're not careful, the vocals are going to, you're going to be having a war between vocals and guitars and overheads
and there are so many people that can do that well. And I just don't, I'm like, here's the song. Go do the mix thing. And it's a bummer because it would be, you know, so much more cost effective and efficient and what if I could do it myself. But I feel like when I finish an idea or I finish a song, I'm ready. I want to move on to the next one, you know, write another one, start recording another one.
I guess it's sort of project specific, you know, like if we were going to go make an album, we would definitely save up and budget enough to hire an outside mixer. I still think for us too, like I'll do some mixing of things, but, I do think it's still worth it to hire an outside mixer for like an album. I don't do that all the time. And there's people who do that all the time. And there really is something
every day
of a benefit to that, you know,
for sure. But there's just so many more little things. There's so many tiny little things that you have to know and understand to really be a great mixer, I think. And
there's a lot to keep up with too. Like that's always changing. Like there's people who are producing, especially now with computers and stuff like there's people who are producing all kinds of different tools and that's never ending. You know, that's always updating. You know, I mean, I guess it's once you reach that level of competency, that musicianship exercise is just a daily kind of thing or a weekly kind of thing. Like anytime Apple's going to introduce a whole new OS, that who knows what everything else is going to happen after that, you know?
Yeah, dude. I mean, I'm really, really trying to get into to realize scoring for film and TV. Like I'm really trying to make that a career move here. And so that is at this point in my musical journey, I mean, I'm 90% in the box because I'm scoring stuff,
right.
You know? And it is unreal how fast it changes, how much new stuff, you know, it's like every time you go and you make a heavy decision to spend money on like a huge string sample pack or a brass sample pack, or, you know, if you want to get the real stuff, you know, and then a month later, they're like, here, this is the new one. And then all the top guys, they're using, that's what they're using. You know, they get the newest, most badass stuff. And it's the same in the mixing world, even more because of how many stacks of little plugins you're putting in. Like that's, you know, strings and software instruments are one thing, but like every new cutting edge. Like, well, now this AI software is going to handle this part of the mix. You don't even have to do it anymore. I mean, that's starting to happen, you know, where like, my writing partner, Ryan Mendez, he was in Yellow Card as well. He's like our mixer in the team and he's amazing at it. But I like, he'll show me stuff that I'm just like, how my dad always says, how do it know? How do it know how to do that? So I'm like, how? So he uses this, this spacer, plugin. We do a lot of electronic stuff. So, we have a lot of, we have a lot of like side chaining kind of four on the floor, almost dancey right. stuff going on that we're doing for not just for scoring, but we're kind of working on a project like that. That's like really ambient and, but a little bit EDM driven. EDM's a loaded word, you know, but it's like, it's electronic, but like string and piano, it's very ambient. But either way, point being, he has this plugin that understands the low end frequencies to like every time the kick hits, it's going to move the bass out of the way just on its own so that they're not competing.
Right. So it's like a smart multiband.
It's like a smart kinda. Spacer. Yes. It's like, and it just it knows how to do it with multiple instruments so that they're all getting out of each other's way. You don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah. It's pretty
That's
gnarly.
Crazy to
and,
me.
And there's probably like presets. You don't even really have to understand frequencies because there's probably presets that are like, what do you want to do? Do you
kick
wanna,
and bass.
yeah. What is this? Yeah, okay. I gotcha.
Yep.
That's kind of nuts.
It's wild, man. It's wild. So, but I love on my side. Just I'm loving learning and getting into like the programming, the software instruments, and the strings and stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. the realism in them is just. I feel bad for string players. I mean, it's just wild. It's absolutely wild. Between the samples that you're playing with now, and then the stuff you can put in line after it. You know, like. The Universal Audio Ocean Way plugins and stuff like that to make it sound like it's in a real room.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, it sounds like an orchestra.
And depending on your project, it's like, is this going to be, like for scoring, this is going to be like mood stuff, ambient in the background with dialogue over it perhaps. Like, yep. Do you really need a symphony session
exactly.
to cover that? Or,
exactly, man.
Or this is in a song and... there's a rock band playing around it. It's kind of like recording a grand piano for your rock song. It yes. never ends up sounding like a grand piano after you put all those guitars on it, dude. You like you no. EQ it down, it might as well be a console piano because it doesn't.
yeah.
You're not gonna. It doesn't matter, you know. Like or right. like you spend all this time getting a good grand piano sound, and then like you run it through the end mix is like it's going through a distortion pedal or something like
exactly. You're using all this like software saturation and yeah. stuff anyways. Do you feel like the stigma, I mean, I know in certain places like in true you know, true blue punk rock, it's not, the stigma will never leave, but do you feel like in general the stigma of like software instruments and stuff like that is changing and becoming a little more accepted, or do you feel like there's still kind of like, you know, well,
I think
you better, it's better if it's the real thing.
I think the stigma is only there in people, it's only there in a slight portion of people over 40.
yeah.
Under like any, I mean, kids now or anybody, like there's no, that is punk rock. You know, yeah. like being able to
yeah,
make
like,
a symphony
I can do
happen.
This in my bedroom. That right. is punk rock.
yeah, that is punk rock, man. Like, I mean, and plus, like, what's your option? I want to hear, like, I have an idea and it involves, like, you know, maybe like a couple violins, like sort of droning on a note. I mean, do you want to hear that?
Yeah.
Or do you want to go broke trying to make
exactly.
it happen in a studio? And
or are you lucky and you have a friend who plays cello or something that could come in and do it? Like
yeah,
that.
Well, that can go a couple of ways too. I mean,
yeah, for
like
sure.
You've obviously worked with string players who can understand playing in a band, but
yes.
there's a lot of people who don't. Like,
right.
I remember we got a friend's buddy who. One of our friends has their dad played in like a symphony, and we're like, oh, this is going to be no brainer, man. We could just have him come down and you know have him play this thing. It's a really simple part, really kind of more textural, and it was like pulling teeth. Like, okay, yeah. Now G, it was like
they don't. Like, yeah, no, they don't. It doesn't communicate that way. Like, it's not.
Yeah, you can't. It's
totally,
not,
totally.
I mean, some people. That's not fair because that's only. That's not everybody. But,
I'll tell you from my experience in Yellow Card. Our violinist Sean, he, you know, he wrote like notated and wrote. I mean, for our second Capitol record for Lights and Sounds, he wrote a full. I don't know how many pieces are in an orchestra, but I'm talking Capitol Studio A. Left to right, all the chairs full with woodwinds and brass and everything. And I mean, he wrote it. Like he wrote these pieces, right? And so he understood both because he came up in the rock band. So there were times when he would kind of laugh in like a musical theory type way of like, no, that's not how you say it, or that's not, you know what I mean? Because I mean, I'm self-taught. I don't communicate in that language whatsoever, but he kind of understood both things. But we had a couple of string players that played on our cellist and our viola player. They played on almost every record we made. There were a couple where one or the other couldn't make it to the session, and that it was a bummer. But we pretty much, they were members of the band almost from a recording standpoint. And they were like what we're kind of what you're talking about, where if Sean didn't go in and physically like change it on the paper,
right.
It was like you couldn't sit in the control room and be like, no, if it was just like if it just cut off like right here where the vocal kind of stops, like just a little trail.
Yeah, you gotta say no at bar 52, third beat. Like
yes,
it, you know.
Yeah, that's I don't speak that language, but it's funny that. How different the forms of communication are, but you know, I guess we were lucky to have Sean who could do both because he was like able to he was like a translator between the band and the string players.
Being able, I mean, it is something I'm envious of that you can like sit down in front of like charts,
yeah,
and
it's nuts.
And shred with all the passion and expression that you could ever imagine, but it's like yep. it kind of doesn't exist unless you have the piece, you know, like it's not jamming at all.
It's fascinating, really. Yeah,
but it's so it's kind of, I wish I had a little bit more of that, you know,
for sure. I mean, I've spoken to people throughout my time working with string players, and we've had a couple of really shredding pianists come in and play on some records and stuff, and I've just been talking to them. It's funny because it goes both ways where I'm like watching this dude just shred the piano, playing some epic warming up, you know, for the session or whatever, playing some insane classical piece of piano and being able to read the music. And I'm so envious of that. They will turn around right to your face and be like, no, dude, I would kill to be able to just sit down at the piano and write something like,
yeah,
just to sit down and just like creatively create a piece the way you do when you pick up a guitar. I mean, so I think it goes both ways because a lot of really classically trained musicians in that world, like, again, it's like a language thing. That's just not the language they speak. They, as you said, which I think is rad, like they will rip it and shred it and play it with like all their heart and soul the way you or I would sing a vocal take. But like a lot of times, even in the studio vocal take, I mean, you're just kind of making it up. You're feeling it, you know? They're like reading it off the paper and giving it that passion. It's just such a different thing.
It's so wild.
Yeah, it is.
It's so wild.
I took a music theory class in college, but it didn't. I was just like, nope, this is not what I want out of music. No.
I was doing classical guitar in college, mm-hmm. and I was taking my whole plan was to do a minor in music. And
how'd that work out for you?
my major was going to be journalism, with photography, photojournalism being like the thing I really wanted to go into. But I mean,
yeah,
dude, it's like either of those things. I mean, I had one half an hour. My guitar instruction class was a half an hour a week, and it took up all of my free time.
Yeah,
100% of my free time was spent for this half hour class because that's what it takes.
Yeah. You know? To learn what you're doing there.
Yeah, to be reading and be playing that fast and just being able to do it. But you know, what I was starting to realize is like that's the same with like a journalism degree too. Like you have to go all in that. You know how competitive that is and know how much, how little money there is and how little career there is, like, especially now.
Right. Like, right.
It's all in, you know, it's kind of funny. I was trying to do two things that were so all in that it was never going to work out one or the other.
Yeah.
But like, I kind of stopped right at the point where some of the theory things were starting to kind of click and make sense. And mm-hmm. then we just started going on tour and sleeping on floors and
same.
And, that was kind of more fun.
Yeah.
Like, I'm fascinated by it, but I mean, there's just no time.
I mean, similar story. I was in the BFA theater program at Florida State. That's what I wanted to do my whole life. Like, that was the dream. I didn't really have a minor option or idea because I was doing a BFA program. So like, that was kind of, as you say, all in, but yeah. It was public school. And so I just never checked in. I hated it. I was like, well, I'm here to take theater classes, not liberal arts math. And like, I just, you know what I mean? Like, there was nothing that felt less practical for what I wanted to do with my life than college algebra. Like, I just was like, and those kind of things turned me off from school, from college so much. I tried twice. I went, I dropped out. I joined a band that wasn't Yellow Card out in California. I moved from Florida to California and was like sleeping on a floor, riding around in a van with a bunch of dudes I didn't even know. And they were on Tooth and Nail Records. And then, that didn't work, ran out of money, came home, went back to school again. And I still was just like, this just isn't my scene. It's not my vibe. And my buddies were from Yellow Card, where I went to high school with them. And that's just how that started happening. But it was the same thing. We just started playing shows and all. And I was like, this is good energy. And I'm enjoying this. And it was also kind of a little bit of middle finger to my parents, I think, to be like, you know, I wanted to go to Boston and you made me go to Florida State, you know, so I'm leaving. I'm out of here. But then Yellow Card panned out. So, but I never had any like as classical guitar kind of stuff, you know. I mean, we grew up on it's funny, our original guitar player was shredding, went to our performing arts high school for classical guitar. So he had like, they all had, him and Sean, they all had the theory because they were all music students from our school. But I was a theater major who like was covering NoFX songs with my friends on the weekends, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I never had that. I just never had that. And it's fine because I'm doing it now, you know. Back to scoring and stuff again. I'm playing so much more piano and I'm arranging all these strings, and while it may not be rooted in exact theory, you know, I'm learning more about the voicing of the chords and the way they work with each other. I mean, just than I ever have probably in my life, because my guitar playing and writing and Yellow Card was just so instinctive. It was just like, again, kind of like we were talking about turning knobs. Like, this just sounds cool. I don't know if it's the right way to play it, but you know, I don't know if you've ever done this too, or like I wrote a riff. I'm so self-taught. Like I would write a riff that someone who was taught would be like, dude, that you, like you can't play it like that. And I would just be like, well, I don't know. That's how I'm playing it. Like, that's how, yeah. It, you know, that's how I did it. So
was that based on, I mean, I'll think about economy sometimes, like when I'm working on a guitar part, like,
yep.
is this thing I'm doing? Could I use an open yeah. string instead of like this?
I have,
this
dude, old Yellow Card songs. I have so many of those. Just
I
like,
can't. Like I go back and listen. I go back and try to figure out like the original way I played something like from 96 or 7, and like I can't do it now. Like I've switched my, it's
right.
like, it's like such as like, how did I get that B string to ring through with this hand position? Like, this is crazy.
Yeah. And like, you don't do anything like that anymore. So
no.
it can't. Yeah. I mostly play, I mean, guitar wise these days, I'm mostly like focusing on more kind of like folky finger picking stuff on my acoustic anyways. Like, I'm so far removed from stretched out,
yeah,
punk and drumlet chords, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I play most, if I'm playing guitar, which maybe sadly is a lot more rare these days, but I'm usually playing acoustic guitar these days.
But that's like, when you're talking about like folky acoustic stuff, I mean, that's kind of based around like open chords then, more or
yeah,
less, right?
I do a lot. I put out a couple EPs last year, in 18 and 19, that were like kind of, I tried to, I tried to capture kind of a like an Elliott Smith meets Explosions in the Sky vibe with them. And
Meets Explosions in the Sky.
Yeah, it was kind of like
That's a cool idea.
Yeah, it was kind of like really, really vibed, chill singer-songwriter, you know, a lot of like rhythmic finger pick kind of stuff with like the first one was really chill and it was just only kind of ambient guitar swelly, electric guitar swelly stuff over. But the second one I did had a lot more kind of like big like post-rock build-ups that would build out of these songs that started like here with a vocal and a guitar. But through that, like I really explored open tunings and I mean, you know, the best way to explore open tunings is just rip off other people's open tunings and write new songs with them. Like if you like hear a song you think is rad, look it up, find out what the tuning is, and then just like put a capo on to move it in a different key and then write. And because it's like people are doing the craziest shit with tunings, you know, so that was fun. It was fun to go learn some songs that were like in these wacky open tunings and then kind of write my own stuff.
Yeah, we have, I had a phase where we were using open E tuning for things.
Okay.
There's actually like four or five songs on Clarity that are open E and like around the Clarity time that was like, I don't know why. Like basically like you write a song.
I never know why.
You write a song around like you tune your guitar all to whatever and you instantly write something cool with it. So then it's kind of like now you got to have a guitar that's dedicated to just that.
I was just going to say your guitar techs loved you, didn't they?
Didn't have too many of those, but like it was really just open E was as far as it got. I think the tuning arms race could have escalated pretty quickly there if I would have kept
going. Yeah, for sure.
Dadgad's a cool tuning.
Everything 2000 All the older Yellow Card drop D, most songs were in drop D, but not Dadgad. I wasn't hip to that. But then starting like with our records in 2010 on like the later ones, anytime I was in drop D, I was in Dadgad. And then in 2014, we had a record called Lift a Sail we did everything in C. On that record, and it was like open C, like yeah. So Dadgad, but C,
but a C version drop of Dadgad, C. Right?
Yes, and loved that. It was just we wanted to kind of make a more like mid tempo, heavier, kind of like alternative record for whatever lack of a better genre word. So loved that, but yeah, I mean on the acoustic when I'm open, it's like I'm just always like. You as you said, you just write something rad, like right away. And on my little like EP tours, that's why I mentioned like guitar techs. My buddy Ryan, who has teched for Yellow Card and for me for a long time, he was just so like, because the acoustic tours were like, this one the B string is dropped to F sharp. This one the E string is E flat. But it's like. And it was literally like every other song he would have to give me a guitar like that. So
yeah.
It was getting into some Goo Goo Dolls territory. You know, I've heard that he tours like, with like 60 guitars or something.
Yeah. Each headstock has tape on it with like the right tuning for it.
For sure. Yep. I got all that when like I got off the road, got all my stuff back and kind of brought it home. I haven't toured in a long time now, but like every single guitar I pulled out of a case had a strip of gaff tape on the back with tuning written on it. So yeah, for sure.
It's kind of fun having the A string and the B string be like an octave, like a double octave.
Yeah, I do. We have some Yellow Card had quite a few songs in drop D, but that were in the key of A, you know, so you like have that F sharp minor drop D chord. And then like, so I'll tune both the B and the high B and A string to, or B and E string to A. So that like just no matter what you're playing, there's always that the major one A is just kind of like playing through.
It's like a drone.
And when I'm doing acoustic stuff, that's just it's rad. It makes it sound so much fuller when you have to play stuff by yourself. You know?
Yeah.
So like and I'm in the process now of doing I stream a live show every month on my Patreon page and I'm like reworking and relearning all these old Yellow Card songs and kind of trying to do them in that kind of more of that Elliott Smith kind of space instead of, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I equate like the older yellow card stuff, like the early stuff, hitting notes was like doing skate tricks. It was like the higher, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the higher the note you could hit, like the more badass it was, you know? And I'm not trying to do that now, you know? I'm not trying to go like, well, B, you know, C sharp, may, or sorry, yeah, yes, B, C, I guess not C sharp, but B, C, that's like the most I could belt and scream something out, you know? So that means I have to do that. I have to do it because I can, and it'll sound so good on the record. And but, you know, and then you get out and you tour it for 2 years, and you're like, why in the hell did I do that?
I know.
But yeah, sure. I'm learning all these songs and like reworking them, and the open tuning is just a way to do it, man. Because you can just like play these songs that and completely reinterpret them, but it's just you and the one guitar feels so much fuller because it's just like there's that drone kind of happening mm-hmm. all the time, you know. So
yeah, it's a totally different thing. It's a totally different thing accompanying yourself.
For sure.
It's a completely different mindset from having the wall of rock behind you to almost hide yep. behind. You're in front and you're singing and people are looking at you, but you're not yeah. you're still behind everything else in a way. Not
also,
true. Not true if it's you and a guitar. It's
not
like
true
you,
at all.
You are the sole arbiter of the direction and dynamic and intensity and success of yeah. what you're trying to do. Like, there's no one else, man.
Yep. And also not being a classically trained guitar player such as yourself, I was always lucky to be surrounded by insanely talented guitarists. So if I wrote something, a lot of times I would kind of write like the foundational riff that like became the song, right? Earlier in the band, at least. But I would write a lot of stuff that then I would be like, there's no way I can play and sing. The syncopation of
yeah.
that and what I want to sing. So here, dude, you do it. But now it's like, I just have to invent a new way to play those songs because there's no one sitting in here with me when I stream a show or when I go on the road by myself. So I have to like learn how to play a guitar part that works with the vocal. I mean, it's funny, like our biggest song ever, Ocean Avenue, you know, it has that rhythm, that dun 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 dun, that rhythm. Forget it, dude. Like chugging that and then also ba da ba 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 ba. There's no way.
Yeah,
like never possible. Yeah. So like when I play that by myself, there's no way to like start the song with like the iconic sound of it really, because it's just not physically possible for my brain. It makes me feel really untalented when I talk about it out loud, but
no, but. I do that all the time. I'll write stuff way beyond my this.
Right.
You know, like all the time.
Yeah, dude.
I'll write stuff beyond that all
That's
the time.
Funny.
And so we have another musician that tours with us and plays with us, who is awesome at everything. He's one of those people.
Yeah. Right.
And I'll task him on the things that I don't want to do singing sometimes. But there's other times where I can't get around it. It's just like the way that the parts are we want to replicate between me and Tom, our other guitar player, and Robin, our fifth Beatle. He you know, there's just sometimes there's no way around. Like I gotta put in the work and I gotta do the you know, this is going da 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 da, and this is going da 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 da.
Yeah, dude.
Like
I know, and vocally it's just so it's so challenging. Ryan would always, our guitarist would always sit with me, and again I would just feel so like inadequate, like that I'm being taught like a kindergartner, like, because I would sit there and he'd be like, no, dude, you sing the win on the and of three. Like, let's do it again. You know what I mean? And I'm playing it. And a lot of times I'd finally get it. I'd be like, oh, it would just click. Like, oh yeah, the and of three. That's where that word goes. Now it fits, you know? But a lot of times I would just be like, no, dude, sorry. You're going to have to play it. Like, I can't do it.
It's super hard. And there is that like, oh God, I suck moment. But then there's also like, I feel Because I've overcome things like that in the past, so I feel like, oh man, this is like, okay, this is hard, but this is me getting better. You know?
Yeah.
Like
for sure.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, this is all right. I know on the other end of this, like there's gonna be a ray of light. It's gonna be better.
Well, I will definitely say too that in the same breath that I would say, you know, kind of like self-deprecate like that, I will say that the guys in my band, and I mean we rotated members quite a bit through our career, but the guys in my band for sure made me a better musician, you know, like hands down. Most of them throughout my career were all much more trained, whereas as I said, I mean I just picked up a guitar when I was 12 and just started making shit up as I went along. I never, you know, and so I feel like obviously I always had a strong knack for songwriting and melody, like that was my strength. But the more technical stuff, it was like, but getting to be in that band for 17 years even under the circumstances that were unfortunate a lot of times with the members changing in the band, it's like I feel really lucky actually that I got to like have the experience with the different guys that I did because they were all so talented, and I learned just so much from those guys who were so much more trained musically than me. So I think in the end it was a payoff to like have to be taught in that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is really it's like forming a group of people that click and work. It's not something that you know, getting like a group of people that all shred and all have that kind of mindset to like together, it sometimes doesn't really work all that well. Like,
yeah, many shredders. Yeah.
Like on paper, like they put these three people or four people together, like this should be killer, but it's really.
Well, they're competing for shred space.
Kind of.
You know, it's like not.
Yeah. You know, it's, I don't know. It is rare that it works out. And that's why so many, like how many bands are in existence right now versus how many bands have you know, broken up with everybody still playing and it's, you know, or it just doesn't work out. Like it's a rare kind of thing. I don't know if there's any like formula to it, but it's just a thing. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying, but like,
well, it's, I mean, yeah. Thinking about what bands that would, you know, I mean, you and I, you're like a little bit, I'd say like one class ahead of us, I guess we could say, you know what I mean? Like, but nonetheless, like coming up through the late 90s and mid 2000s and when we were putting out kind of our like most successful records and all that, it's like you think about what bands are not only still active, but are still active with the exact same members that they had at that time. I mean, I would be hard pressed to come up with like three. You know what I mean? I'd have to really sit down and think about it. So, it is. It's challenging, and it's a bummer that it can't all just be copacetic all the time. But you know, it's a bunch of people in a group that are all, you know, seeking attention for themselves through creative expression at every turn. Like,
yeah,
it's always gonna. And like push the boundaries for what you can tolerate with each other, and like everyone is guilty. It's everyone in a band is guilty of the things that go wrong in the band. Like they're, you know what I mean. You want to say like, well, it wasn't me, but it's like you have to take responsibility for the role that you play in the band, and especially when things go wrong in the band. Because there's no way, dude. There's no way you're off the hook. Everybody is a part of it.
And what 22-year-old is going to have like the wherewithal to kind of sit back and say, you know what? I'm guilty of this too.
None.
None. It's
taken me 20 years to come to that you know, space,
yeah.
mental health wise for me, and to be like, okay, like let's talk about the part you played in the things that went wrong in the band, you know.
it is funny. It's kind of like that time in your life where you can just go sleep on floors for 4 months and it's okay. Like that's also probably your least actually emotionally mature time. You think you're,
for sure,
that whole time you think you know what you're doing, but you don't know what you're doing. And
well, I mean I think it's crazy like how we were just thrust into that as young adults, like with no, you have no world experience, like no life experience, but you're more than most people, you're being like thrust into the world.
Yeah, especially like, if you have a successful record, you know, like it's like, yeah. What?
Yes, dude, international touring, all that stuff. It's like, I mean, dude, it's overload. It's overload for anyone at that age. And I respect and admire and, you know, think about all the time, like the few that go through that process, not only remaining, you know, true to like having the luxury to kind of like find themselves early in life and like staying true to like the right things and doing it all for the right reasons and, you know, taking that touring experience and all those things and like letting it enrich their lives and not letting it be like stumbling out of Rock in Osaka at 6 a.m., you know, like 5 years in a row and not being like, well, one. I already did that. So let's maybe, you know, it's like, and I know people like that, that got through that time and just were, you know, they ended up, their family men, you know, got married young, have kids, are still married. They had that whole thing of like, but the idea of most of us, I think, being like 23, 24 years old and all of a sudden just like, oh yeah, you're on a plane to Thailand tomorrow. You're on a plane to South Africa.
You're on
a plane,
business whatever. Class yeah, to South yes. Africa right now.
Yeah.
What?
I know. It's what? Yes. And then to be, I mean, I don't know if it's expected or what, but you know what I mean? Like to be expected to just handle all that and come out the other side, you know, everybody focused and driven and like agreeing and all, it's like you take five personalities or four personalities or whatever and put them through that experience. Everyone's going to experience it differently. It's going to impact everyone's home life differently. It's going to, you know what I mean? Like you're never going to come out the other side of that with everyone being like, oh yeah, we're the same people we were before we started flying business class to South Africa. Like, It changes everyone, and it's just wild.
Can you imagine the Hanson guys? Like, what they got to go through? Do you know them at all? Do you know them at all? Like,
I got to hang one time. Full disclosure, Hanson rips. I don't know who thinks, I don't know, like, if anyone thinks otherwise, that's your call, but they shred. And I know this because I mean, I didn't grow up listening to Hanson records, but I was in Hollywood with a friend who's kind of more of a Hollywood friend, you know, and was like, hey, dude, we're going to go to this thing tonight, you know, kind of one of those.
We're going to do some Hollywood and, stuff tonight, man.
Yeah. And so I got to go to a nightclub thing, whatever it was. You know the Avalon in Hollywood? I don't know if it's called the Avalon anymore. Yeah, remember the Avalon?
The old palace. Right by Capitol.
Yeah, across the street from Capitol. Yeah, so there's a club above that. There's like a kind of indoor-outdoor bar club thing up there.
Yeah.
And so I got to go to that space. Who knows what it was called at the time, but got to go there. And it was however many people could fit in that space to see Hanson play on the floor with, like, dude, I'm not kidding, like PA speakers on stands. I mean, it was like they don't have an audio system in that place. It was like... And so it was totally analog. It was a piano, you know, guitar and bass, or drums and guitar and bass or whatever. And some floor monitors and these two. And dude, it was like, it was transcendent. I mean, their vocals were like nothing I'd ever heard live before, ever, ever, ever. But this is like in 2012, probably.
Yeah.
You know,
no, those guys, I mean, like I bring them up because they're like... Like we both kind of had breakout moments in like early 20s ish,
yeah.
And that was kind of they a lot were like to handle. 10. They were like 10, like, and they, man, what they've had to mentally overcome to like still have a career and have real fans and keep making like music that they love and they own Tulsa. You know, they pretty much just own Tulsa. Yep. Like they have.
I mean,
a
they
crazy
have a little empire.
There. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, holy cow, man! Like that's one in a billion right there that happens.
Well, I think I equate that to like you talk about in a band, you know, it's brothers or brothers and sisters. It does evolve into that kind of sibling mentality without you even trying for it to be. It's like, I mean, how can it not? You you're sleeping in rolling bunk beds for months on end. Like, it's like,
yeah,
that's going to happen. But those guys are actually brothers. You know what I mean? And I think,
yeah, okay.
I think that gives them an advantage. I mean, because at the end of the day, they don't get to just be like, you know, and like, that's it. I really don't have to think or care or evolve myself in your life. It's like they're connected by blood.
Right,
I mean,
no,
I think
they got to make that.
I think they always had that to hold on to. And I mean, I'm sure there was a better ability to like check each other. I mean, you know, dude, like if someone in the band is getting out of line, like it's like, who's going to talk to him? Who's going to, and then it's like this huge thing where if it's your brother, there's a different vibe there.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The bus justice is going to only go so far. If you're related.
Back lounge meeting.
Back lounge intervention.
Oh man. Had a few of those on both end, both receiving and giving.
Man.
Had a few of those.
Good times.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Man. Hey Ryan, thank you so much for hanging out with me, man, and chatting about songs and production and all this stuff. It's really cool, man. I'm glad we finally got a chance to like talk for in person.
Yeah, me too, man. As I said, man, I mean, like your band is a huge influence on me, and so getting to do this is not only just like a huge honor, but I mean, it was just really rad to finally get to hang, dude. I mean,
yeah.
So I guess keep in touch now, dude. Let's be buds, man.
So, yeah, totally.
But I appreciate it, man. Really, thanks for having me, dude.
I almost laughed when he called me classically trained. He calls me classically trained and then goes in to talk about the key of something, and I didn't know what he was talking about. I just kind of played it off like, yeah, of course. Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's something you learn in college, is how to fake it. We did get a little bit more nerdy this time. I'm going to try to work more nerd stuff into this podcast. If you couldn't tell, I'm a nerd in my heart. I hope everyone's doing good. Thank you once again for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.